Greetings, and welcome back to the podcast. This episode, we are joined by Mr. Paul Colburn, President and CEO of Surge Energy, a TSX-listed energy company with a market cap of approximately $1 billion. Mr. Colburn has been a part of a long list of successful energy companies, including being the founder and CEO of StarTech Energy, which grew to approximately 15,000 BOE a day and was sold for approximately $500 million to the ARC Energy Trust. Mr. Colburn was also the founder, president, and CEO of StarPoint Energy Trust and was the founder and CEO of Crescent Point Energy. Mr. Colburn has also been a chairman and or director of TriStar Oil and Gas, Westfire Energy, Twin Butte Energy, Sequence Energy, Seaview Energy, Breaker Energy, Mission Oil and Gas, Legacy Oil and Gas, New Star Energy, Red River Oil, Rising Star Resources, Privity Capital, Lex Capital, and Jog Capital. Mr. Colburn earned his undergraduate degree and Bachelor of Laws degree from the University of Calgary. Among other things, we sat down and discussed the founding and sale of StarTech Energy, Surge's current 0.7 debt to cash flow ratio, and why dividends are good for investors. Enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Galatea Technologies. Galatea is a software company based in Calgary that is focused on helping producers better manage their fluid logistics. Galatea enables field operators and truck drivers with the ability to make the optimal decision on every waste, water, or clean oil load, resulting in 20% savings on trucking and disposal costs. The Galatea platform makes it easy to create digital truck tickets, manifests, and shipping documents that automatically flow through the field data capture and finance systems. Galatea's platform is used by over 50% of Canadian producers, 600 trucking companies, and hundreds of disposal locations. Visit GalateaTech.com to learn more about how to optimize that last line on your lease op. This episode is brought to you by Canada Action, whose belief is that the Canadian oil and natural gas industry is a force of good in the world, and that history will look back upon the sector favorably. Canadian energy plays a critical role in our society by reinforcing global energy security, underpinning Canadian economic prosperity, and setting the benchmark for environmental leadership. Get your free stickers at buildcanadaup.ca to show your support, or follow Canada Action on social media. Good morning, Mr. Paul Colburn. Thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here and love the questions you've got for me, so I'm looking forward to it.
I know your time is valuable, but there's a lot of people out there that will appreciate your insights. You've had a lot of success in many areas of your life. You were a corporate lawyer, energy executive, UFC quarterback, you're a good dad, son played in the NHL, kids, various professionals. So I guess the question is, how do you do that? Do you sleep at night?
Yeah, no, I'm a pretty driven person, but I get a lot of fun out of competitive sports. I took my law degree and my economics undergrad at U of C, played quarterback for University of Calgary, but also played pretty high level baseball and basketball, kind of team sports. And I love the team approach to things, but also the competitiveness. I'm a pretty intensely competitive guy. Practiced securities banking, oil and gas law for about 9 years at a big law firm and two large oil companies. And then thought I'll try and branch out and try the business side of things. And I've been lucky enough to work with four different teams and build four of the top oil companies in Canada: StarTech, Crescent Point, StarPoint Energy Trust was a huge win, and now Surge. It's kind of thrilling. And I'm just a lawyer by trade, so it proves you don't need to be an engineer, geologist, or geophysicist to create a good company and have a good result. And so, yeah, it's been a fun ride.
Like we discussed, I thought we could structure the conversation into first a little bit about you and the early days, maybe of StarTech, then get into Surge. But what is Surge Energy?
We're a larger oil and gas company, mostly oil, on the Toronto Stock Exchange. We're 25,000 barrels a day now, 87% light and medium gravity crude. And we're almost everyone's top pick or a top pick for oil in Canada. We have two of the top four plays in North America as independently ranked by Peters & Co. and Raymond James last year. When oil prices go up, we have the most torque, meaning our cash flow goes up the most. When a price of oil goes up a buck, our cash flow goes up $8.9 million per year as a company. So in December, crude was 68. Now it went over 86 this morning. So you should start to see us. We did in 2022 outperform, and I think you'll see it again this year. Surge outperform.
To go back to the beginning, did you always want to be an entrepreneur?
I am entrepreneurial, although I had bills. I got four kids and a mortgage at the time. So I was a lawyer at a big law firm, moved in house to Husky Oil for 4.5 years, and then a year at Wascan Energy in the legal group. And after 9 years, I'm like, you know, I wouldn't mind trying the business side. I saw a lot of buddies of mine that were on in football with me or other sports or things. And I'm like, I'm just as smart as that guy. I want to try it. And with four kids and a mortgage, and I'm like, my wife is kind of wondering, what are you doing? I wanted to try the business side and branched out with a few other partners, top guys, engineer, geologist, accounting guy, and a partner at Sproul, geologist as well. And we just had a great run at StarTech Energy. It was my first company, and it was a lot of fun. That, and the learning curve was straight up. Like, there was, we didn't know the first thing about running a public oil. I was doing well as a lawyer. They were doing well as an engineer, geologist at big companies, but we didn't know how to run a big company or a good company at all. So great, great challenge, great learning curve. And StarTech was a big win over first 8 years of my career in oil and gas. And we sold out to the ARC Energy Trust for over $500 million. And that kind of gave me the confidence to start Crescent Point. It was a great win. We're 16,000 barrels a day, kind of a little darling. We sold. So I'm sitting there for a year and deciding what to do. So then I start Crescent Point with a good new team there. That was a huge win. So it kind of gave me the confidence to go out, and the track record in the market to go out and start Crescent Point was that first run at StarTech.
How old are you when you started StarTech?
So after 9 years in law, I was 36 years old. I knew a lot about doing deals from my legal days and raising money and doing that, but I didn't know a thing about running a public oil company. And it's funny, we had a good group of us, and we're sitting, you and I are sitting at a table now. We had all left and we all agreed we're going to start up this one day. So we all come to the StarTech little tiny office, and we did not have anything. We had a few hundred barrels a day of production. A good balance sheet. I'd raised $25 million to start, but we didn't own any assets. And we're sitting around a table looking at each other going, what did we just do? Giving up careers at good companies. But the strength of the team and everybody combining the skill sets, we had a really fun, good run. And there were great teammates, great management team partners I had there.
It's 1993 and you've just started StarTech. What are you thinking? I want to grow this and collect some nice dividends? Or are you thinking we got to sell out as quickly as we can? What was the thought process?
Good for you. So the darling of the day was Renaissance. Canadian Natural kind of came a bit later, but Clayton Woitis, a friend of mine, was running that. And they had just been going for 10, 12, 15 years. And straight up to the right and growing a company. There was market recognition for growth, which there isn't right now. Renaissance grew. And they were kind of the blueprint for everybody. Dividends were a thing. They were not the focus at that time. So there's a period of just the market responding. And if you could project the growth and go hit your numbers, your stock was going up in a semi-Renaissance model. So Berkeley, Amber, Baytex, Cypress, StarTech, Remington. There were a ton of good oil companies at that time, and we're all growing. At 1 year, I remember we spent twice our cash flow to project, you know, 25, 30% annual growth, and the market loved that and would pay up for it. Now, I think your stock could go down if you tried to project that because they want sustainability, dividends, shareholder returns, share buybacks, low debt. Things have changed, and probably for the better for shareholder returns. Probably things have changed for the better. But yeah, our goal was keep building StarTech. And it was also where I learned about my first downturn in 1998, 99. Crude went to $8 a barrel. We were 16,000 barrels a day of about 75% oil. It was harsh. And that's where you start to learn the cyclicality and go, oh, maybe the shares don't always go up to the right. Maybe they can collapse. Which I've learned, I think I've had four huge collapses in my career. So managing through those downturns, like the one during COVID recently, which is historically bad, gives you good perspective. So now yes, I want a growth surge, but, you know, StarTech, that was a good exit because we survived the downturn. Our stock started to really roll, and then we rolled into ARC Energy Trust paper, and the stock kept going up in ARC shares, and it was a good exit for shareholders.
How much of your own money did you have to put into StarTech?
I did not have a pot to piss in. I had no money whatsoever at StarTech. I think I put in, I'm going to say, $25,000, and I probably had to get a loan from my father-in-law to do that. We did not have a lot of money, none of us. I had a lot more to put down when I started Crescent Point, but that was good. It made us hungry. It made us intense, and we made good money out of our options, which ties you with shareholders. The downturn in 1998-99 was horrific, but we survived that and did really well out the back end of that downturn. So I did not have much capital put into my first company.
Did you always feel it was important to put your own money in companies to bleed, so to speak, if your shareholders bled?
Yeah, good for you. That's a good question. So yes, Crescent Point, StarPoint was good that way. So when I came back to run Surge, I was on the board and chairman, and I had taken 6.5 years off. Our CEO, a good guy who's still on the board, Dan O'Neill, had heart troubles, and the board asked me if I wanted to come back. So I said on three separate things. I want to sell this one asset that was a non-core asset, lower our debt. I want to put $2.5 million more equity capital into work at Surge, and then I want to convert it to a dividending model. The greatest investing model of all time, it's irrefutable. Ned Davis Research, worldwide recognized research, shows that the increasing compounding dividend model is the best investing model of all time. Unless you're smarter than everyone else and you can go pick the next Tesla or NVIDIA or, you know, Microsoft or whatever, which a few people maybe can do that, but by and large, Warren Buffett and others have proven that the increasing compounding dividend model is the greatest investing model of all time. That's what Surge does. That's what I've done my whole career, that model, and smart people get it. There is big volatility in our business, so we're now starting to run our oil companies like Surge. We have one of the better balance sheets. We're starting to run with less debt than we used to have in the past. People used to say debt of 1.5 to 2 times debt to cash flow was great. The banks had revolving credit lines, so every 6 months they'd renew the line. Well, during COVID, they decided to leave. So now we're all running Surge's debt to cash flow is 0.7 times, and it's even grinding lower. So there is a change that way. And our big focus is Surge has the best free cash flow yield of any oil company in Canada in our peer group. Nine Point Partners pointed that out, which is Eric Nuttall's firm. We're pushing that out through debt repayment, a juicy dividend. We bumped 14% last year. We're almost ready to bump it again at probably before the end of Q3, but we have a super low payout ratio. We're keeping that. And then we're going to start our share buyback program. And as we hit our last debt target, sometime Q2 in 2025, we'll probably add about a 3.5% to 4.5% production per share growth wedge. So we're pushing that one of the best free cash flow yields in Canada out to shareholders, but in a different way than the past, which was just growth, 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 grow at 20%, grow at 25%, grow at 30%. We're not doing that the same way. And it's actually way less risky for shareholders too.
Some people would say your first company is the hardest. Was it tough to break in to start StarTech? Has it gotten easier?
When I look back at it, nobody accepted me. I mean, I had a good 9 years in law and stuff, but everyone's like, you're just a lawyer. What do you know about running an oil company? And I truly had to say nothing, but I'm intense. I want to learn. I've got great partners. It was kind of a good mix. The management team, we had a top geologist, Kel Johnson from Husky, top engineer from Mobil, Petro-Can, Murray Mason, Peter Bannister came over. He was a partner at Sproul, geologist, Ned Studer. So we had a diverse, good backgrounds in the management team that we could draw on for different issues. And I was a securities lawyer. I knew how to raise money, do transactions, do debt financings, do mergers and acquisitions. So it was kind of a good fit. But at the start, my first year, not one brokerage house picked us up. Not one firm said, hey, buy this stock. This is good. So we're small. We did one takeover in First Energy. Brett Wilson and Jamie Mackey backed me and rolled their company called Joss Energy into StarTech. But that was the first time we ever got research coverage. Now Surge is covered by 12 of the top analysts in Canada, and they all have us as a top pick or their firm's top pick for oil. So you earn that over time. And then Crescent Point, I had the track record. So we took off way quicker in the market. And it's that track record. You have to kind of go get it with actual doing it rather than just, because everyone the first year was like, will we ever get one analyst to pick us up and promote our stock or recommend it? But it came. It came pretty quickly. And I love it. Steep learning curve was a great challenge and a lot of fun.
Did the success of the company surprise you at all? And what did you do the night you sold? Did you go out and celebrate?
You bet we did. We went from $3 a share to $19.80 a share in the hot market at StarTech. And we went back to below $3 in the horrible downturn when oil went to $8, survived it and sold out to the ARC Energy Trust around $11. And their stock took off and went to $35. Plus, you were getting dividends. I love their dividend model. So it turned out to be a big win. We definitely survived the downturn. So yes, we went out and partied after. And I was not surprised. I still believe you don't have to be an engineer, geologist, geophysicist, or whatever to do well. But you have to, I think, have those skills and team. In your management team, you better have those skills at the table when you guys are considering various issues.
Throughout the companies, you've been good at capturing value, aka knowing the right time to sell. Did you think about that? How did you go about that? What was your thought process?
I'll tell you, to your point earlier, at StarTech, we are like, let's grow it. The same Renaissance can do it. They did it for 15 years. CNRL was starting their great run. Al Markin was running it. Murray Edwards is chairman. So they were kind of following Renaissance. And we're like, no, there's the two of the top firms and they're growing it and they've got a growth model. Renaissance kind of blew up and sold out, and CNRL is a juggernaut. Now they moved into the oil sands. That's been an amazing move. They're just a juggernaut company. So, but surviving the first downturn, the volatility went, oh my God, this can be really volatile, this oil industry. So Crescent Point was a great run. I started it, founder, chairman, CEO, and chairman of the board, but I brought in a great team with me. Scott Saxberg, Dave Belutis. We had a really good team initially at Crescent Point, and we had a great run. And then I was chairman and CEO by then, and I was like, okay, do you guys want to keep going? I'd made good money, and I was going to do other things. And the team said, no, we want to keep going and grow it. So I promoted Scott Saxberg to president. He had a great run. He built a good team. I stayed on the board as chairman and then ultimately stepped off all the boards when I came back to run Surge. But sometimes I've timed it right. Like StarPoint Energy Trust, we built a great company in 3 years. Stock went from $3 to $26.75. We sold to the Kinetic Energy Trust and we timed it right. For once, I got the timing right of this sector. But some companies, they profess the team and everything and they want to go on. So I wouldn't say like Surge right now, we're set up to go at least. If we're in year three of a 10-year bull run for crude, Surge is it. We're the oil story. I think us and Headwater in the intermediate space in Canada are the oil stories. We've got the runway, the drilling, two of the top four plays in North America, low debt, great dividend, low payout ratio. We're it. And don't take my word, take the 12 analysts that are in our corporate presentation have said, Surge is it. Well, that's exciting for me. So we are set to go, but I'm not in a rush. I'm enjoying it right now. And it's actually fun again with oil at over $85 a barrel. As I said, we have the best torque, cash flow, upside torque of any oil company in Canada, says National Bank in our presentation. Well, that's exciting. So we're set to go a longer distance if we want to.
Do you remember the day you met Scott Saxberg? And did you realize this engineer may be a little bit smarter than your average Joe?
Scott's great, but I've been blessed with teammates like our COO here, Murray Bai, is one of the top engineers I've ever worked with. He's up there with Scott. Murray Mason, my first vice president of production at StarTech, was a beast. He's brilliant both on production, reserves, water flooding, reservoir. And I had other top guys like Trent Yanko, and I'll think of some more. Scott was definitely good. And I think the reason Scott had a lot of success, and I did as well, is let's be honest. Let's be fair. Let's not over-glorify Paul, Scott, or anybody. When I started Crescent Point, the long-term average for crude was $18 a barrel. We got the benefit of it going to 147 and averaged 92 WTI for 5 years in a row before the downfall in late 2014. So as great as we can all say we were, we kind of got some amazing benefits. The amazing benefit of crude going from $20 a barrel to 100, that's almost unprecedented. So Scott is great. The team was great, and they decided they wanted to keep going. So I just said, okay, I'll be chairman and then a board member and then off the board when I came back to run Surge. But Scott was definitely one of the top guys I've worked with. I've been lucky, though. I've had gone out and tried to source and pick really good teammates to support me, especially technical guys, because I'm not an engineer or geologist. And I've got Derek Christie came over from Crescent Point with me from Crescent Point. He's our vice president of geophysics, or Murray Bai from Encana, trained as our COO, and on down. We've got some top, top technical guys at Surge.
How much of a company is instinct? In the sense, for example, even if you told somebody how to build Surge or say a Tourmaline, they wouldn't be able to do it. How much of it is kind of instinct?
There is a little formula I found out, and it's beautiful because everyone on this call, if you're not an engineer, geologist, or geophysicist, I'm just a lawyer. So I found out this, and it sounds so trite and so silly. You're going to laugh at this. High quality, low cost, low risk conventional reservoirs that water flood wildly outperform deep, expensive, tight rock with huge cost to drill, huge fracks, huge declines that don't water flood. Top conventional low risk, low cost assets wildly outperform deep, expensive, tight rock. And that's it. There is no more, no less. And I'd love to say how great I am and wave my arms and say it's all about me. But the bottom line of it, what I learned is even the top engineers and geologists, it's 2 miles under the ground. They don't know any better than you and me. Now, they have tools where they go, what's the height of the pay? What's the width of the pay? What's the volumetrics? And then you find out, oh, I didn't have seismic in the edge. I thought this thing went for sections, and there's a zero edge, meaning the reservoir is cut off. So the trap was not 3 miles away. It was 300 meters away. It's tanks under the ground. It's volumetric tanks under the ground. Now, top people do top work and they try their best. But I found out that the margin of variability is massive. So that's why having your own top people, and that's why I've succeeded. I've been lucky enough to get really good technical partners with me at four different companies. And I'm very, very, I think, different than most people in my management style. I'm not autocratic. I go and get the top people in Canada I can attract, and I can attract some pretty good people. And I have an amazing amount of intensity and competitiveness. I want to be the top performer in the country. Well, in 2022, Russia invaded the Ukraine and oil went to 125. This is a rhetorical question for you, Trevor. Whose stock was the number one performing public oil stock, dividending oil stock in Canada? Surge Energy, 112% TSR in 1 year, total shareholder return. I mean, stock price going up plus dividend. And oil averaged 94 WTI, and we have that incredible free cash flow torque. In 2023, we were not the top performer. Oil averaged 77, so it went from 94 to 77. We had a great year, paid debt down $62 million, all this, but our stock was not the top performer. Now, early 2024, crude oil prices are ripping, and they went over 86 this morning. Whose stock is up 35% in 7 weeks, and who's starting to outperform all the peers in oil? Surge Energy. So it's fun, but I want to be the top performer, and I think we won the award for the top business in the oil industry surge. I was lucky enough to get it, but our company, I would attribute it, got it. Top performing oil company at the Calgary Business Week or whatever. That's great. I want it in 2024 too. You're never going to get it every year, but I wake up with an amazing... Now, it's funny. Mike Rose wants that. Grant Fagerheim wants that. Brad Herman wants that. The other top company CEOs, they want it too, just as much as me. So who's going to get it? And the thing I can point to over time is having top team members and treating them like a team. I'm not autocratic. You're with me? Your vote's the same. We go into a managed meeting. Do we buy this company? Do we buy these assets? Do we put more capital into drill? Do we cut back? All the decisions you have to make. Your vote's the same as mine. So you took business at UFC, and I want your opinion on everything the company does. And that way you get a collegial team of top guys and ladies that all contribute. And everyone's vote is the same, but when we walk out of the room, we're 100%. Nobody is going to go, I told you so, or I was against that, or whatever. And we have it out until the point where we walk out with unanimity. We're together. But I get 6, 8, 10 top people all throwing stuff on the table. And it's such a volatile, risky business. Having perspectives, you took business, I took law. If we get a top geologist, engineer, land people, whatever, it makes it harder and harder to make a mistake if you have 6, 8, 10 top people all with input in a team, collegial team approach. I'd say it's the thing I can point to, having done it 4 times with 4 of the better companies with 4 different teams. And shocker, people want to work at Surge. They wanted to work at Crescent Point. Top people, A, they want to be the top performer. They want the competition. They're top people. And B, they don't want to be working with an autocratic guy or lady who's an autocratic president telling them what to do. They want to come and feel they're partners at the business and equal partners in the management and enjoying the success and the failures and everything together. So I'd say that team approach for me has been one of my collegial team approach, my real things I can point to, go and get top people, and then have them as real partners where their vote's the same as mine.
You lived and succeeded through the growth phase of the 1990s, early 2000s in Canadian energy. But did you ever stop and think to yourself that we need to slow down and balance growth with cash flow and profits?
Good on you. I think I'm one of the first that did because I was a growth guy. StarTech, we were growth because everyone, all those companies, Berkeley, Amber, Baytex, Cypress, Remington, all these guys, we're darlings and we're trying to be the next renaissance and grow at all costs and spend 150, 200, 250, 300% of cash flow and just grow 30, 40, 50. I didn't say grow rationally, grow smart. It was just growth. Well, then people start to realize that might not be the best for shareholder returns. So I stopped pretty quickly that. StarTech, I didn't, but I think it was selling StarTech to ARC. And I'm like, that is one of the best models I can imagine. One of the fun things about this business is owning these elite, big oil in place water floods that go harmonic and start to go flat. And they start to kick out cash flow every month with almost no drilling, big oil in place quality reservoirs, and then sharing the cash flows with shareholders. So I quickly, Crescent Point, I think we were really early. I think we converted it to a dividend model at 10,000 barrels a day. Well, I stayed on the board quite a while and Scott grew it to 170,000 or 80,000. But the dividend model, I love it. And it turns out, I don't know that many people have done the research so that their business model fits their operating model. I could have a high growth company with a 45% decline. The dividend would be not very sustainable because I got the treadmill of a 40. Surge, we have a low decline, 23%. We want it even lower. We water flood incessantly. So our business model matches our operating model, if that makes sense. So we can truly not be focused totally on growth, but on sustainability of the free and generate free cash flow and then push it out to shareholders, debt repayment, dividends, share buybacks, and a modest growth wedge.
Sometimes success in life is avoiding things. It's the things you didn't do. Are there any deals you think back on and you're glad you didn't pull the trigger on? And
a lot of those deals you look back and go, that didn't work out that well. And usually it's something like commodity price uncertainty. Let's just say you bought a natural gas company. I've never really been and made any money in natural gas, but, and you didn't hedge, say, and the price of oil is $80 a barrel and you buy this oil company and you don't hedge and oil goes to 40. Oh my God. And even though you love the assets, it's a good deal, whatever, you didn't go the next step and protect the cash flows, pay the money back. So your debt's high because oil prices dropped. You didn't hedge. So you kind of wish you'd have been a smarter person. So yeah, definitely can look back. And that's part of developing a track record is acknowledging the downturns are severe. But if you're like a CNRL, they're a juggernaut. And in the downturn, they started buying companies for the Montney gas. They bought Storm, they bought Painted Pony. And when gas prices go again, they'll be able to trundle out this nice gas fairway of land. They're not drilling it now, but they'll be set for that moment when they can. So yeah, I look back now and see a lot of deals. Some of them are good that you didn't do. Good question.
Just a quick thank you to one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back to the show. This podcast episode is sponsored by Conate Water Solutions. Do you need cost-effective water sourcing options to supply your next drilling or completions program? Conate Water Solutions is a specialized hydrogeology company focused on water well drilling, testing, and water management services in Western Canada and Texas. Contact info at conatewater.com or check out conatewater.com for more details. You've been in a leadership position for a while. Seen lots of data. When you look back on things, do you remember a play that you knew was going to be good that maybe got away? And on the flip side, are there any that you really feel you captured, really got ahead of? For example, everyone knew there was oil in Martin Hills Clearwater for a long time. Did you get a sense on some of those plays? If you
look I have two. Luckily, I can say I have two where we captured them. The Bakken play in Saskatchewan did not work under the technology of the time. We drilled two of the wells in a company called Starpoint Energy Trust, and they were risky, and we drilled them, and the Packers Plus technology was not there. So we used gel the first time for the fracs, and the frac blew right through the gel. It did not work. Then we used Packer assembly that wasn't quite good enough, and then boom, it turned, and the Packers Plus technology started, the technology started to ping pong between Mission Oil and Gas, Crescent Point, a little company called Bison, and Petrobakken. And it just started to ping pong back and forth and get better and better and better. And within about a three-year period, a 3.5 billion barrel oil field developed. And it, shocker, it didn't stop at the border. The same Bakken gets cooked way deep in the Williston Basin down in the U.S. and comes up north. It didn't stop at the border, but no one had cracked the nut. Even in North Dakota, the wells weren't like they are now until the Packers Plus came in, and it was like, oh my goodness. So Crescent Point, we moved quickly. Mission Oil and Gas actually was the real one. We spun it out because it was too risky to be in the trust. Mission took off and went from $1 to $17. Crescent Point bought it to mop up more and more of the Bakken. And at one point, I think Crescent Point, we figured we had 60-65% of the sweet spot of the Bakken, grew it to probably 50, 60, 70,000 barrels a day. So that's one we captured. And you're going to laugh right now. It's on our corporate presentation. You got to check out the hottest play. You mentioned one of them. Good for you. If I told you that the hottest play in Canada right now was a 100-year-old play drilled vertically, the Manville Stack. And in the Manville horizon, there's a series of formations. One is the Clearwater, which is heavier to the north. The Sparky, we picked the Sparky, not the Clearwater. So I missed out on the Clearwater, but we got the Sparky and about 9 years ago created a dominant position. We stayed out of the heavy window, but it's an 11 billion barrel trend from Edmonton southeasterly to the Saskatchewan border. And about 7 billion is in the goo. The heavy oil, the real 10, 12, 14 API goo, I call it. And it was Husky's turf when I worked at Husky. They have the upgrader, the refineries, the terminaling, the trucking, the pipe downstream. They got the big refineries now in the U.S. and Cenovus owns that. Well, I said to our team, are we going to be able to go in and compete in the Manville Sparky with the big guys like CNRL, Husky, Cenovus, Exxon? No, we're not. So we stayed in the 4 billion of the 11 billion barrel trend that's in the light and medium window. And we've gone from 1,000 to 12,000 barrels a day now. And it's so exciting because we're the big dog in that 4 billion barrel field. And we've captured over 1 billion barrels of the 4 billion. We're having excellent drilling success. We've grown it. A water flood's like a dream, shallow conventional water flood. It's the fourth ranked play in North America based on well payouts as per the Peters study that's in our corporate presentation. But this study is just well payouts. It doesn't include water flood. If you included water flood in there, I think the Sparky'd be way ahead of Martin Hills. Now, Martin Hills may prove to water flood. I think Spur is trying to water flood it now, and it looks like it probably will. And it's about 22 API, so it's not super heavy or anything. So yeah, I think twice I've captured it. I've lost out on some like the Clearwater and the Montney. I've never really been a Montney guy. So yes, we've stayed oily and very West 4 lower cost drilling. We don't want to drill $15 million Duvernay wells that are tighter than, you know, they're basically tombstone. So yeah, ours is low risk, conventional shallow reservoirs with big oil in place, and we've stayed out of the heavy window. Good question.
Like I said, you've been in a management position for a while. You see a lot of data and maybe seen some of these plays come around full circle. Do you ever think about it in terms of preserving optionality? Make sure you, like, who knows? This play may be turn out really well one day. How do you think about that?
We're always trying different things. So we have a play now that I can't speak about, but started it 4.5 years ago, developed it, drilled a couple wells. It looks good. We're out buying more land. So yes, that one was, I don't want you to think just because we're a dividending model, a DivCo, a lower risk one, that we don't take some really exciting shots. So we've had both the Frobisher in Southeast Saskatchewan. We're drilling some of the best wells in North America on well payout. It's the best play in Canada if you can get it, the Frobisher. The wells pay out in 6-8 weeks at these prices, 500% rate of return wells. So we've captured a really exciting position down there and gone from 0 to 8,000 barrels in the last 3 years. But the Sparky's one where we've also captured one of the best plays, and it's your longer life water flood asset as well. So kind of a nice mix of lower decline water floods and the high net back quick payout wells that we get in Saskatchewan.
Before we get into Surge a little more, you haven't had to work in a while. What motivates you nowadays?
And that's a really good question. People don't, they ask me that too. It's like, it's just funny. I'm wired a little differently. I get up excited, happy, and intense to go and outperform. It's just, I still think it comes back to a competitive sports background, teams and whatever. So you get a good team. So let me put it to you. Are you going to go get a great team, aspire to be the top company in Canada? And the key is not to get too down in the downturns and know that it will turn. And oil is turning in a different way. We'll talk about the macro at the end, but I don't think anyone has a clue. I think we have a massive worldwide shortage of oil caused by 9 years of chronic underinvestment. And it's so exciting. But why would I, the day that I don't get up and want to be with a top team, one of the top performers in the country, that's the day I'll pack it in. I'm just wired to, I still enjoy it. I'm having fun with it. But I can honestly say, I think I love the competition. I see all the CEOs. We're all good friends. We meet at the conferences. I see Grant Fagerheim, Mike Rose. I see Jason Jaskla at Headwater. The top companies, we know who each other is. And at the end of the day, there's going to be one top performer, and it's pretty much going to be driven by asset quality. Either have the good reservoirs. Well, that's why I'm so proud of this chart that Peters did. There's only one company I'm aware of that has this. You know, we're going to be close to 85% of our production coming out of two of the top four plays in North America and a 12-year drilling inventory and 3 billion barrels captured. It's us. And I want that competition, and I want the thrill of 2022. We're the top performer. 2023, we were not. Had a great year, but, and we're all hungry now, and now crude's ripping, and we have that, I mentioned to you, that torque in our cash flow because we're 87% light and medium oil. You start to see our cash flows rip when oil goes above 75. At 85, it is insane what we can throw off from a free cash flow point of view. What's nice too is the investors get that. So our stock should be one of the top performers this year. So you asked a really good question there, I think, because I love having fun too in a model like we have where I'm spewing out the cash to you in a dividend or I'm spewing it out to you by paying debt down so your net asset value per share is going up. Simple numerator, denominator. And we add a little growth wedge, but not a big one, because I don't want my corporate decline to go up. And if I drill more, my sustainability goes down. It's fun. And we just got back from an amazing 2 days in New York. I haven't had a trip like that since 2014. And 2013, when I came in to run Surge, we're the top performer in the Toronto Stock Exchange my first year, beating out Grant and Whitecap narrowly by like 1% or 2%. And our stock went from $268 a share to like $11. My point is, no one has cared since 2014. We go to New York with 7 meetings and to a couple broker meetings. So 9 meetings in less than 2 days. And people see Canada as undervalued, probably going to get some government changes and get a more supportive government to the oil industry. They're looking to put money to work in Canada. And I have not seen that in almost 9 years.
The big fish from the States. Do you see them coming up north to refill the hopper for a snack in an undervalued Canadian oil company? Does that worry you?
It doesn't worry me because, you know, the market is the market. So our stock is starting to outperform. The securities laws, when I was a securities lawyer, get a load of this. I wanted to buy your company to do exactly. I'm Devin or somebody big from the States, and I see you have a really good asset base and something I like. I launch a hostile on you and you only have 35 days. In fact, it might have been 25, but I think it was 35 days to come up with a white knight. So you got to have a data room, a process, get somebody an advisor, hold a thing in a month and get a white knight to come in and trump the other bid, knowing they might trump you. I'd probably just go, yeah, screw it. I'm not going to. Now it's 90 days. It's almost too long. And if you remember when Husky took a run at Meg, it lasted so long. It was like a call option that Husky had. And then oil prices tanked and Husky went, yeah, screw it. We're not going to go ahead with it. But you asked a better question, I think, is somebody's going to want to own our Sparky position. And our Southeast Saskatchewan position's good, but is it the reason someone would come up and try and buy you? Probably not, but it's really good. Don't get me wrong. But the Sparky, remember, yesterday, Mexico announced that they're going to take 400,000 barrels a day of their mine crude they were supplying the market and use it and stop exporting it and use it for their new big refinery that's 400,000 barrels in Mexico. That scared the market. Diffs are already have come down from $21 in December to like $12, $13. And then you got TMX coming on in the next 3-4 months, they say. We'll see. Well, that's going to take line fill and everything. So medium gravity diffs, which is like our Sparky, it's not heavy oil. It's medium gravity, but it does get hit with the variability of WCS differentials. But where a heavy oil barrel might get a $3, $4, $5 discount because it's goo, and you got to add diluent, it doesn't flow, whatever, sand issues often. Ours has no sand issues. It's 24 API, so it's true medium gravity. It gets about a $3, sometimes five, but $3 to $4 premium to WCS pricing. Somebody going to want to own that, and probably a big integrated company that can get the oil down to the Gulf, because those refineries need the medium gravity crude, because it makes, when it goes up the cat cracker, it makes all the other products that light oil can make the light ends, but all the heavier products right down to asphalt and asphaltines and diesel and things is the medium gravity crude. So it's become a really valuable barrel in the Western Basin, or Sparky, say. So someone could come up and want to own that. Well, that's good. I don't mind. We'll get our stock back to 12, 14 bucks. And if somebody wants to make our day, let's go. In the meanwhile, it's turning out to be one of the top plays in North America. And we're the dominant player in that light and medium window. Obviously, the heavier window was Husky, CNRL, Cenovus, those guys. But I think we're building an asset base that somebody could want to own.
In terms of Surge now, dividends or buybacks? Are you leaning one way or the other? Does it depend on the stock price and scenario?
This unfettered thing of, oh, I'm just going to indiscriminately buy my stock back. I'll give you an example. Copper prices rocked and BHP was one. Rio Tinto, they just were buying their stock back. Why? Because it made their stock price, helped it make it go up. And then it didn't. And copper is just like oil. It's a commodity and it has huge variability. Copper plunged. They all got fired and they all ran their debt up and stuff buying their stock back. We're going to be the exact opposite of that. $75 oil, Surge's proven plus probable independent Sproule report says that the shares are worth over $17 a share, brand new. Well, oil's 85. So if I used $80 deck a year ago, which is what it was a year ago, our shares P plus P were $22. Our total proof case is 1127. A year ago, it was 13 on an $80 price deck. Well, when the Russian invasion occurred, our stock went nuclear. We went from 368 a share to 1350 in 5 months, 6 months on the Russian invasion. I would pull back from buying the stock then, right? Put it more to debt repayment, tweak the base dividend, maybe do a special dividend. Tourmaline's been brilliant at that. So was Pioneer and some of the other companies. If you have excess free cash over and above, in our case, we got our balance sheet down to one of the better debt to cash flows. We'll keep chunking a bit of it onto the debt, but we'll bump the base a little, add a little growth wedge, start our share buyback, but use it judiciously. Warren Buffett said, his quote was, share buybacks, you should only be considering when up to core value. So whatever you guys think, I would say in our case, core value for me, P plus P, $17, no. In this moment, I think it's going to change and the price deck for Sproul will change. So I might buy it higher than that, but I would say our total proof case means drilling only about 350 of our locations out of 1,050. That's 1127 a share right now. Yeah, I'd buy our stock back to that. And if oil prices rip further, heck, I might buy it up to $15. But in the meanwhile, I'm going to tweak the base dividend. Not, we've had some of our teams in Calgary and we get bad connotation when you go to New York or Boston or Toronto, people like, why are you guys bumping your base dividend so much? It's not sustainable. I wouldn't bump it much. I've seen some guys bump it way too much and have to cut it. But bump the base, have a special dividend, have a share buyback that you're going to use when the market's acting silly. Either way, you're going to stop buying when it's $15 and you're going to buy the heck out of it when it's $5. Kind of use it judiciously. That's probably one of the most asked questions I get. But I like all of them on a capital allocation basis. If the market's acting silly, like it was in December, our stock traded at 601. Buy the heck out of it. Now our stock's 820 or 30 or something. We're everyone's pick for oil. We're going to hit our next debt target. We could bump the base dividend when we hit it. And it looks like in Q3, so only two quarters away, we could bump the dividend 100%. Well, I'm at a 6% yield now. I'm going to maybe bump it 8 or 10%. That's it. Pay debt down more, buy shares back. Then when we hit our next debt target, I can bump the dividend another 100%. I won't. I'll just bump it 6, 8, 10% because I don't want to get in a position where I'm having to knock down the base dividend and make it unsustainable. So very good question. That's probably one of the most asked questions. And particularly shareholders in the US, they seem to like the share buybacks because the withholding tax doesn't hit that. And if I turn down the share buyback, nobody gets mad at me. If I turn down the base dividend, you're going to come looking for me and go, Paul, I like that 6% yield. Why did you cut it in half? So on a share buyback, you don't have to do that. So I like both, actually. I like paying debt down, which we've got one of the best balance sheets now. I like the base dividend on a low payout ratio. I like share buybacks. And then Tourmaline's, Mike's done a brilliant job. If the price of gas goes to $7, $8, he's going to lob out some nice special dividends every quarter. We're in the same boat. If crude stays here or goes higher, we'll be looking at special dividends in the next, you know, few quarters.
Sometimes the market's a fickle beast. They like the bird in the hand, so to speak.
Yeah.
But you have the internal information to know where the best dollar is spent. If you got a great play, that, like Buffett said, your money is better spent in the company growing it. How do you balance the demands of the market with what you see internally? And is there pressures that you have to kind of balance?
One of the best things I learned, because I probably spent my first 10 years running Surge and even Crescent Point, running around, not pandering, but being so inquisitive and so worried about what shareholders thought. And then some really smart people over time have said to me, you know, shareholders don't run companies. Management teams and boards run companies. And if you run a really good company and you're the next Renaissance or CNRL or the next ARC Energy Trust, guys are going to want to own your stock and don't worry so much about the stock market. And then if you ever get a chance, I'm going to bet you didn't read this book. What's the greatest investing book of all time as per Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger?
Intelligent Investor?
Good for you. Benjamin Graham, The Intelligent Investor. It's boring as hell. But chapter 8, and I'm a lawyer, you're a business guy, so you probably understood it better than I did. Basically, I think it said 5 or 6% compounding over the long term is really good. But chapter 8 was so good because it said, the stock market has absolutely nothing to do with the value of your company. What it is a mechanism if somebody wants to get out that day or in that day, they can trade, and it's got fear and greed and bullishness and negativity and every other thing mixed in there. When it was first drafted, they were coming out of the Great Depression. So it's kind of like they've done since annotations for the Great Financial Crisis on real estate. And then I think they'll be doing one probably on COVID. But the amazing thing was him talking about these brilliant companies that got crushed. And I remember a fun little quote from Jeff Bezos. So he grew it. I remember these numbers. My son showed me. It's only like a 45-second little snippet. A YouTube video I think I watched. So he's like building Amazon, and he realized he can do more than just deliver books in a van to a house. Oh my God, I can deliver all this other stuff and blow up my business. So the business was blowing up, but he got caught in the downdraft in the year 2000, and he could not believe it. So his stock went from like a buck to 106, and every single thing in his company was going so well. But because he was in the horrible meltdown in 2000, his stock went from 106 to 6, with everything in his company blowing up to the good and just, oh my God, I can grow earnings. I can deliver all the things Amazon can do now. It just shows the extreme negativity. And you go look back at 2020, Greta Thunberg, everybody said what Greta said is right. We're never going to use crude again. When we talk about the macro, you are going to be charged up, I believe, when you see the actual reality of the macro right now. Yet crude traded to a minus 37. It traded down to $11 in the physical market, and people were so desperate to get off their crude contracts, they were willing to trade them at $37 a barrel negative in April of 2020. Well, now we're in a worldwide shortage of oil, and oil prices are going up to the right, and I think there's a shortage. So the negativity, that's why I'm glad. Good for you. You read Benjamin Graham's. I could, honestly, it was very difficult to read. But I love chapter 8. He's like, don't worry about the stock price. Keep your dividend going and the stock will look after itself. So I've kind of been less worried about what shareholders think. Because if I ask 12 shareholders, some in the US, some in Canada, some in Europe, some like the dividend, some like this, be like herding cats. We go, here's what we're doing. We're really conservative. We're really good. We have two of the best plays in North America, and we're drilling great wells and spewing out nice dividends. We're going to bump the dividend. Our debt's low. Our payout ratio's low. Buy surge. That's our story. And it may not make, and the other thing I'd say is sell your shares. I'm okay. I used to think I had to sell every shareholder at every meeting. It consumed me. And Jim Davidson, who was formerly president after Brett Wilson left, but Jim said, don't even talk about your stock price. And that's their business. They're judging whether you're cheap, costly, whatever. Just talk about your company. Might have been Crescent Point even. And I went, you know, you're right. And I don't really focus on it that much. Yes, I want to be a top performer, but if we grow the best company and have the best assets and free cash flow yield and dividend and everything, people will flock. Well, you're starting to see us people flock to our company now. So very good question.
Speaking of the company, like you mentioned, the core areas are Sparky in the Southeast Sask area. So I guess the question is to get away from the source. Why? Why Sparky and why Southeast Sask?
It sounds so trite, you're going to laugh at me, but I'm saying this to you right now, Trevor. You can go do this if you want. But you need good technical people helping you, and then just a religious focus to not spend growth capital chasing reservoirs that don't meet the criteria. So it's all about permeability and porosity of rock. So this slide we have shows, again, please don't hit me because it's so simple sounding. Big oil in place, high quality, low risk, low cost reservoirs with 0.1 mil at RC and better rock that have low declines and water flood dramatically outperform 0.1 mil at RC and tighter rock, huge costs, huge fracs, huge declines, basically super tight rock that doesn't water flood. Well, if I want to get a 5% recovery factor in the Duvernay, I have to drill frac, and floods won't work. And I'll have huge declines because the wells, it's tombstone. So you're actually fracking to create permeability that's not there in the reservoir. And the wells cost, you know, $12, $15 million a well. In Surge's case, our wells in Southeast Saskatchewan cost $1 million, $2 million, $3 million. They pay out in 6 weeks. 500% rate of return, shallow conventional reservoirs, low cost. They don't even need a frack. But our Sparky, it's only 700 meters depth. You're looking at 10, 12, 15 million barrels in place per section. Beautiful sandstones with up to 30% porosity. Water floods like a dream. So you put your dollar in, the well pays out twice in the first 2 years. That's what gets it on the best well payout. Then if we water flood it, it goes harmonic and it gives you your money back 8, 10 more times under water flood over the next 30 years. So as great as Paul can say is it's the reservoirs. And then I will say this, the discipline to say no to deep, expensive, tight rock. And it's enticing because, funny, those are the assets that always come up. The Montney, the Duvernay, the Permian. Okay. But if you get caught in a time when oil prices drop or gas prices drop, you can't drill them because the wells will never pay out. Strip gas is below $2 now. It looks like it could go below $1 again this summer, maybe to zero. Well, how can I go drill a Montney well that's going to be 70, 80% gas? To get the liquids, the gas becomes a byproduct. It just, my point is, we're 87% conventional light oil, medium gravity oil, no heavy oil, no gas to speak of, in big oil in place, beautiful water floods. Well, why are we putting out these great quarters when a lot of our peers are in the Montney or in the Duvernay and they're having to pull back because their gas isn't cash flowing? And this is still the end of winter. God knows what it's going to be this summer for gas. And oil's $85, which is ridiculously good for Surge. So that's my whole career. I'd say the one thing I can point to is the discipline, but a guy, Jerry DeLue, our former BPX, was head guy at Devon Canada for a couple decades. He's going, you have to talk about your rock because you have the low-risk reservoirs that worked in the 50s when oil's $3. They brought the super majors and super independents up to Canada in the 50s. That's how good the Shaunavon, the Sparky, Southeast Saskar. Well, imagine how good they work at $83 oil if they worked at $3. And then I just say the PIR, the economic side of it is the rates of return go through the roof for a conventional reservoir that gets harmonic, water flooded, and you get your money back 8, 10 more times under water flood over the years. So that's kind of our secret sauce, if you will, for Surge. We're low risk, low cost, high quality reservoirs.
You basically just answered the question, but the debate is you need to enter the resource in the Montney. That's maybe what some other companies in Canadian Energy have done that. That's their argument, but.
Well, yeah. So you make I get asked about it all the time. You make a call as a management team. So I'm just saying this to you. You were a business. So I'm going to ask you this rhetorical question back to you. How often does Costco want to turn over their inventory? Surge, we have 1,050 drilling locations. We drill 70 a year. So 13, 14 year inventory. Now you never want to drill your bottom third. So we have 675 of the 1,000 locations are juicy tier one, two tier locs, ranking as some of the best in North America. That's about an 8 year inventory, 9. And I never want to drill your bottom third because those are your tier threes, which are slightly lower economics or more risky, whatever. Costco probably turns over their inventory every 6 weeks or 2 months or whatever. That's their model. Isn't every business that way? Why do I need a 20-year Montney fairway, which I can only drill when gas prices are high? Well, gas prices are only going to be high in Canada when we get some governments to approve LNG. We got one approved. US has 11, and they're taking over the world LNG markets that we could have been taking over the last 8 years. We chose not to for, we all know the reasons. My point to you is I don't want that risk of that kind of reservoir that it's there. I can tell you the Montney is there. There's townships of it. But do you want to be drilling a whole bunch of Montney wells this summer when 60, 70, 80% of your output of your well is natural gas when it's $1? No, the wells won't pay out. Anyways, I just believe on any business, if I have a 12-year inventory, 14-year inventory, and even 8 or 10 on tier 1, tier 2, I don't need it to be 20 years. So we're kind of the unicorn because when I was at Husky and Wascana Energy, they were big conventional producers. But if you had a 2 to 3 year inventory, you were happy because they're so big, you got to keep putting it into the ground. Well, we have a 12, 14-year inventory and maybe 8 years of tier 1, tier 2 drilling in two of the best plays in North America. that's enough, I guess. And it isn't like my guys are taking the year off. That's what we own today. Last year, we replenished more than 100% of our drillables in juicy tier 1-2 looks. So that's what our geos do every year and our guys. So it isn't like we're not replenishing as we drill the 70 wells. We're really good at replenishing those.
Do you see further consolidation in the Canadian energy space?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely do. So it's a great race now. But remember, it's a cost of capital game. The guy who gets his cost of capital quicker than the other guy buys the other guy. So get a load of this. This is just how they reacted. Shell, BP, pandered to climate change activists and put out ridiculous things that said they would sell. Like, think of Shell selling their oil assets in the Permian for $9 billion in the downturn to, I think it was Conoco. It'd probably be worth $25 billion today. Because they believed little Greta and climate change activists in Europe, and they're from Europe, head office, Royal Dutch Shell. BP did the same and pandered to it. And now all those management teams are fired, gone, and most of the board. And the new teams are like, listen to the guy from Shell. Do not judge me based on the prior management teams. We are here to grow our oil, grow our cash flow, grow our earnings, and grow our dividends for shareholders. And the new teams and boards, well, the two companies that stuck to their knitting, Exxon and Chevron, their stocks wildly outperformed BP and Shell. Now, it isn't like Chevron and Exxon are anti-climate change. They just stuck with their mantra of we're going to grow our oil and we're also going to be good climate change corporate citizens like Surge. So what did their shares do? Well, they wildly outperformed and at all-time record highs of their stock, they went out to buy Pioneer Exxon and Chevron Hess. Now they're fighting over Hess, but my point is their stocks outperform. So they get a cost of capital advantage. They're letting out way less stock than Shell or BP, whose stocks are barely starting to come out of the basement because of what they did. So it's a cost of capital game. I do believe there's going to be more consolidation. Not yet, but as Surge, we get back to our total proved net asset value of $11.50 and use an $80 price deck, it's probably close to $13.14. Well, we start getting there. And a bigger company goes, hey, I like your Sparky. Maybe it's a Cenovus because they're Husky in through that area, or a Whitecap, or a Tyne Energy, or Adam Watrous in Strathcona. What we built is something that's big with running room. Somebody may come and knock us on the head. We may go knock someone else on the head. So I do think more consolidation's coming. It'll be tied back to whose stock's outperforming, who's got a cost of capital advantage. He ends up generally buying the other guy. The great circle of life in our business. It happens all the time. Cost of capital is key.
So when the day comes that you are getting the correct cost of capital, how do you decide whether to sell out or start rolling others up?
I'm always looking to roll others up. I've been very acquisitive. What's so crazy is the last year we bought Enerplus just over a year ago. So a year and a quarter ago, beautiful 4,000 barrels a day, right in our two core areas, our Sparky core area, in Southeast Saskatchewan, beautiful big oil in place water floods, which really keep your corporate decline low. And we saw drilling upside at Cadogan in the Sparky, 15% accretive to cash flow per share, bumped the dividend 14%. The market loved the deal. We went out to raise $40 million on the deal. In one day, the book was at $270 million on a $40 million raise. We big sized it to $80 million. 31 of the top analyst institutions in Canada came in on the deal. All I'm saying is there's still a pulse out there for the market. So I'm always looking to roll other guys up, but we are stringent on our definition and our due diligence on asset quality. With a 12-year inventory, 8 years, if I'm being true to what I told you earlier, we haven't bought a thing in over a year, which for me is hard because I'm pretty acquisitive. Because our inventory, we keep replenishing it, and we're in two of the best plays in North America. So we've had a really good organic last 15 months, delivering all our numbers. Like in Q4, which we just put out, we were supposed to exit the year December 31 at 25,000 barrels a day. We averaged over 25,000 barrels, nicely over, for the whole fourth quarter. So we had a big beat on production. Now commodity prices ripping. So it's quite exciting in the sense of with a big drilling inventory and nice water floods like we have, we don't have to buy anything. But if our stock rips and we get a cost of capital advantage and we see some that's nicely accretive, fits our core areas, we wouldn't hesitate.
On the other hand, Do you ever think about it in terms of saving up, putting money in the bank? It's a escalator type business. You have to replenish the warehouse, but do you ever think about it in terms of saving up for maybe?
So we are saving up. Good question. A few years ago, our debt was $595 million. Now our debt is going to exit Q2 at about $255 million. So that's kind of saving up. Now our debt to cash flow, we had a good balance sheet when COVID hit, 1.6, 1.7 times. White cap was about 1.6. But the world changed and the banks decided to take away the revolving credit lines. So now our debt's 0.7 times, plus we're paying our dividend. So we are saving up in the sense of we could use our balance sheet now. We have lots of room in our line. Our line just got expanded to $210 million. We only have $45 million drawn. So we have lots of room to go after assets and private companies and public companies if we saw something. We just don't see that much that fits our criteria right now. And remember that point I said to you, discipline to stick to the top quality assets is what I can point to over my career as a non-technical guy.
Do you create a margin of safety for the fickle bankers who might pull your credit line in?
We didn't, because for 100 years, they were the best, cheapest source of capital in 100 years for our industry was 4.5% debt from the major chartered banks. Now, they were getting pressure from climate change activists in 2020 and 19 and 20, 21, like everybody was. So National Bank's been great. Some of the other banks are coming back now. I don't begrudge anybody, but I'd say I'm no longer assuming a good balance sheet is 1.5 to 2 times debt to cash flow. In the U.S., they used to run it 3-4 times debt to cash flow. Now we're running it 0.7 times, and I'm going to even get it down to about 0.5. So we are doing kind of that in our model by paying, like last year, how healthy is this? And this was not a high-priced oil year. Last year's surge, we weren't the top performer, but get a load of this. We cash flowed $292 million. $94 million of it was free cash flow. So we paid debt down $62 million, paid our dividend, beautiful 6.5% yield, low payout ratio. And now we're going to add, pay debt down some more, start the share buyback. But it's because we have this huge free cash. It goes back to that cash for oil, the torque, we have it, and a lot of other guys don't. And that's our advantage today. And that's why you see our stock starting to outperform. I expect it to.
One of the main jobs of CEO is risk management. Figuratively speaking, what keeps you up at night? What worries you?
Oil prices and my lack of control. So good for you. Risk management. We have a risk management program. So what we found is $80 WTI, you're now in the 80th percentile of prices. With it today went over 85. The strip has moved up over 80. So we're starting to hedge some of that. Now you can hedge a fixed price hedge on the forward curve. It's backwardated. So it's at 86 today, say 85.50. I can hedge 80 for a year. So that's backwardation. I can do a costless collar at 75 and get maybe 90. That is appealing to me because we look great. So we're already looking at different structures, but in your words, what keeps you awake at night? Volatility of commodity price to the downside keeps me awake, I'd say, because that we now have our debt low enough that I'm not really worried about the banks because it's quite low now. So I'd say that volatility of commodity price or oil prices for us to the downside. And we did some great hedges a year ago and we went, hey, what's our break even? And we went around 65 WTI. So we did 65 by 95 callers. That's actually too wide, I think. If my break even on my capital and dividend is 65, let's do something that's better than that. So we're thinking 70 WTI is your floor, a hedge with a costless collar, it's called, and I keep the upside up to 90, say. That looks appealing, or 85, 90. So good for you. I'd say that's my number one thing. We don't need capital. Capital availability used to be the big one. Am I still going to be able to keep growing and investors pay me a good price for my growth? Well, they're not. They're actually doing the, they're like, show me you're sustainable. Show me you have a dividend. Show me you can do share buybacks. Show me basically you have free cash flow. Well, free cash flow is the new earnings in our business. Earnings have been a joke for our 75 years in our industry. In 2020, a bunch of guys sat in Belgium, IFRS guys, trying to speak from Belgium and make us figure out what they're talking about in the oil industry and in Canada. So in one quarter in 2020, we wrote down our assets $600 million. 2 quarters later, we wrote up our assets $600 million. So my earnings went down. I looked terrible. What a terrible company. Surge is CNRL. We all had these huge write-downs. 2 quarters later, oil recovers and we're writing up our assets $600 million. Oh, look how great. But free cash flow doesn't lie. What's left over after your costs of production? That makes sense. All your costs, G&A, production, everything. Well, who has the best free cash flow yield in the country? I didn't write this. In our peer group, Eric Nuttall, 9 Point Partners, wrote that just a few weeks ago, Surge Energy. So that means our barrels, it kind of goes back to that chart. They are the best barrels. The highest netback, lowest cost to get on there are Sparky and Southeast Sask. Well, that shows up in your free cash flow or earnings. So smart investors like you and others are going, earnings, great. Show me you have the best free cash flow yield. Mm-hmm. After your cost of production, I will buy into it. And we have it.
Advice to a 30-year-old Paul Colborne.
You can have an amazing career still in this industry for the next 20, 25, 30 years. A lot of these things being talked about are lies. I'm just going to say to you, when I started and it goes tiny bit to the macro, because that's what a young professional like you or others are going, is there still legs to this, or do we need to go into tech, or should I try the next AI company or whatever? Well, how about this? For the first time in history, there's now 8 billion people in the world. We've gone through, Britain went through its industrialization in the 18, 1900s. The US then did. Western Europe did. Then the US, then Canada. Okay, but that's only like 1.5 billion, 1.7 billion people. Today there's 8 billion. 6 billion people out of the 8 are all industrializing at the same time. This has never happened. So China, 1.4 billion. India, 1.4 billion. The rest of Asia and Africa, 6 billion people need every barrel. They want our lifestyle. So pop quiz for you. You're a wealthy North American. They want our lifestyle. What do we use as wealthy North Americans to create this amazing top lifestyle in the world? How many barrels per day per capita do we use?
Probably fail this miserably, but I know it's multiples. It's 10, 12 times more than the underdeveloped.
Good for you. So we use 20, it's on a slide in my deck here, but 22 barrels a year of crude we use as wealthy North Americans, Eastern Europeans, to get the highest quality standard of life in the world. Well, China has stated they want 10. Do you know where China is now? After 20 years of industrializing, they're only at 3.3, and their lifestyles are starting to take off. India is at like 1.5. They're 20 years behind China. They've stated they want to get to 6 or 8. Do you know if China and India even get to 5 or 6 barrels a day per person per year? We need like 125 million barrels a day of crude. And that's with all the electrical cars and all the other hydrogen things and green things we can think of. That's the torque that's happening. There's a brilliant firm on Wall Street called Gehrig Rosenzweig, and they're a commodities firm, and they do the studies, and they call it an S-curve. Once a society is industrializing and starts to use more crude, they're hooked on the heroin. They don't use less per capita, they use more. So China is definitely on the S-curve and starting to use more per capita. India is right there and starting to. But then you add the rest of Asia and India. So like I said, when I started in the business 30 years ago, the world needed 68 million barrels. It's now 102.5 this year. And it's also growing at the fastest rate per year of any time in history. It used to be 200, 300,000, 500,000 barrels of growth in oil demand per year. Now it's 2.5 million per year. And you got to replace a decline, worldwide decline of 5 or 6% on the 100 million base and grow it. That needs an investment of 700 to 800 billion US per year as an industry. And do you know we've been investing in the last 9 years? 450 in COVID, 300. So I mentioned at the start, 9 years of chronic underinvestment. Oh my God, it's so visible for oil. Twice in my career, I've seen crude oil go up fivefold. In 1972, I was just driving around in the back of my parents' Woody station wagon, and Saudi put the Saudi oil embargo on because the US and Canada helped defend Israel. So the penalty to us was, so crude went from $3 to 18, like almost overnight. Then it sat there for 50 years, and then it went from 18 to 147. All I'm saying to you is, with the amount of liquidity pumped into the system during COVID, have you seen the Canada M1, M2 money supply? It's the worst run-up in the G20 of dollars printed. More dollars are printed since 2020 to today in Canada than all other dollars printed in history. And all I'm saying is, when that happens, it's inflationary, and oil is one of the best hedges there is. So my advice to a young person starting out is there's a great career in crude oil. And India and China and Asia, they don't care what Greta Thunberg says. It's just like Canada. Our CO2 emissions are 1.5%. We're the fourth biggest producer in the world. We could be paying for all our social services, not running our debt up massively, not running our taxes up, and not issuing the most paper of any country in the G20. We chose not to. We're going to hate oil when China's pollution is 27%. Well, why don't they go over there and stop them from it? 1.5%. Why don't we be like Norway? Be a big climate change activist who also maximizes the value of their incredible North Sea production. They have a $2 trillion U.S. wealth fund that pays for all their social services. Why can't Canada do that? Why do we have to hate the oil and vilify the oil industry? I don't know, but it's happening. But for a young person, I love the feel of a great career in the oil industry. It's been amazing for me. It's fun to see finally the meetings coming back and investors going, oh, you guys actually have amazing cash flow. Here's my point. It's another pop quiz for you. What is the normal investment ratio in the United States on the S&P 500? The energy stocks are contributing 19% of the cash flow of the S&P 500. What's a traditional weighting and what is the weighting now of fund managers for energy in the S&P 500 when they're contributing 19% of the cash flow to the S&P 500? What's the traditional weighting and what is the actual weighting?
I'm going to get this wrong. I think someone told me it is currently 6 or something, and usually it's around 10 or 12.
Okay. You're pretty good.
I don't know.
It's 12 to 14 is a normal weighting and it's at 5 to 6. Good for you. But doesn't that say, wow, there's lots of room for the oil industry and these stocks to go up and the oil industry to, because we're cash flowing. I'd say, Serge, we look good at 75 oil. At 85, it's almost ridiculous, the free cash we throw off. I sent you that little blurb yesterday. So I got one for you. Since December 20th or something like that, crude was $68 a barrel. And today it went over 86, but I used 84 yesterday. So, you know, what is that? $15 a barrel. WTI, oil's gone up in 3 months, 4 months, 3 months, and differentials have dropped and the Canadian dollar hasn't budged. So our free cash flow has gone up $150 million in 3 months. Not cash flow, free cash flow. We already look good at 68, but at 84, it's insane. And that's why you start to see our stock outperforming the peers, because we're the oil story.
Well, that's it covers the waterfront in terms of, I guess,
surge. I had a blast.
You and thoughts on the macro, but maybe to wrap things up, if you were to leave the investor with a message about surge, we've basically covered it already. What would you leave them with?
We are the oil story. Say us and probably Headwater is a great company. They're a bit smaller than us, but growing, and they're on the Clearwater. They're a bit more, I'll say, exploratory kind of. They've announced that they're going into a new area on the Saskatchewan side of Cold Lake and going to, you know, roll the dice and hopefully that'll work out. They're just brilliant. They have a great balance sheet, good team, but we're kind of the oil story in Canada and we've kept our mantra. So I think you'll see us. We haven't kind of gone into the Montney or the Duvernay and we've stayed in two of the best plays in North America. And now we're seeing the benefits, the low drilling costs, the quick payout of the wells, the free cash flow, the water flooded harmonic lower declines in the Sparky in particular. So you're starting to see us outperform. So that would be my message. And the truth is, we're just going to show it by continuing to put out good quarters. That's the bottom line. You can talk as much as you want. Once you start putting them out, investors are like, wow, we need to own this stock. So great end question. Thank you.
We can end the formal conversation there.
Enjoyed it. You got good questions.
Hello, listeners out there. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Hopefully the episode provided some insights. If you enjoyed the show, check out trose.ca where more episodes are yet to come. You can also subscribe to the podcast where your token of support is much appreciated. Until next time, happy coffee drinking.